You're listening to DTFHN for July 13th, 2026. I'm your open-sourced and unlicensed host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue with people who criticize things. Today's got that restless builder energy, the kind that looks at locked doors and reaches for a screwdriver. Let's get into it. When does bluntness become a public service? There's a norm in tech that you don't trash talk to people who leave your ecosystem. Someone migrates off your language, your framework, your platform. You wish them well, you keep it classy, you protect the brand. It's good politics, and most of the time, it's the right call. Andrew Kelly broke that norm this week, and I think he was right to do it. Here's the situation. Anthropic acquired Bun, the fast TypeScript runtime originally written in Zig, and orchestrated a massive agentic rewrite into Rust. Then they waited 2 months before explaining why. 2 months during which headlines like Anthropic's Bun Rust rewrite merged at speed of AI did exactly the marketing work you'd expect for a company approaching a $1 trillion IPO. The technical explanation came after the narrative was already set. Kelly's response was blunt, uncomfortably so. People called it a meltdown. But Ray Myers, who spent years as chief architect of a coding agent startup competing directly with Anthropic's tools, read the same post and found himself cheering out loud. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Anthropic did produce a working migration. The code compiles. The benchmarks run. If the technology works, does the marketing around it really matter? Maybe Kelly is just bitter about losing a flagship codebase. But that framing collapses the moment you look at what's actually being sold here. Anthropic has raised $132 billion. They cannot show profitability. What they can show is a story. That coding is going away, that AI will replace software engineering, that this rewrite proves it. As Myers puts it, Anthropic is an unreliable narrator. They need you, or more precisely, your C-suite and your retirement fund manager, to believe in a future where their models do everything engineers do today. That story has consequences. Real people make real staffing decisions based on it. Real engineers lose real jobs because a manager read a headline and panicked. When a company with that much capital and that much incentive to exaggerate wraps a technical migration in a narrative designed to inflate its own valuation, someone should say so plainly. Kelly said so plainly. The deeper tension here is worth sitting with. Zig allowed zero AI contributions. Bun now claims near 100%. These are two fundamentally different theories of how software gets built. One that says human craft and human understanding are non-negotiable. Another that says the machine can handle it. Both positions are genuinely held, but only one of them has $100 billion marketing budget behind it. The tools are real, the capabilities are advancing, that part isn't smoke. But the timeline, the inevitability, the suggestion that engineering itself is dissolving, that's the part where you need your skeptical hat, when the entity making the claim is also the entity selling the solution. The burden of proof doesn't get lighter. It gets heavier. Kelly broke decorum. Sometimes, decorum is what's standing between people and the truth. Moving on. In 1969, the International Union of Railways agreed on a standard rail gauge coupling system that would let a passenger board a train in London and step off in Copenhagen without once thinking about the fact that they'd crossed 4 national rail networks, 3 signaling systems, and 2 track voltages. That decision to make the interface uniform while letting each nation's engineering remain sovereign is the same design philosophy that gave us TCP/IP, and it works for exactly the same reason. Terence Eden just published his notes from a 7-week, 6,379-kilometer interrail trip across 13 countries. And what makes it worth pulling apart isn't the destinations, it's the infrastructure. One pass. 13 countries. 40 hours of actual train time spread across 7 weeks. He walks into a station in Brussels, taps a QR code, and boards a train to Denmark. The carriage breaks down in Nyborg. 1,000 passengers need rerouted, and the system just absorbs it. Next train. Keep moving. He crosses from Sweden to Finland on an overnight ferry with an interrail discount. The pass works on the ferry. Let that land for a moment. A rail ticket that works on a boat. Because the system was designed around the journey, not the vehicle. This is what interoperability looks like when you build it into the foundation. Each country runs its own rail. Different seat configurations, different lounge policies, different attitudes toward vegan meal options. Germany's DB requires deep examination of your pass before grudgingly letting you into the lounge. Sweden's trains have vending machines on board. Finland's Wi-Fi is excellent. The implementations vary wildly, but the interface holds. Compare this to flying 13 countries in 7 weeks. You'd interact with 13 airline booking systems, 13 baggage policies, 13 security feeders, each one a walled garden optimized for extraction. Change fees, bag fees, seat selection fees. The airline model is closed by design. The rail model is open by design. And the open model lets two people wake up in one country and fall asleep in another without ever opening a booking app. One commenter captured it perfectly. That is scribe walking into a major station, looking at the departure board, picking an enigmatic destination, and just getting on. No reservation, no algorithm, just infrastructure so well designed that spontaneity becomes the default mode of travel. The builders of this system made a choice decades ago. They chose the open standard, and 60 years later, a couple from England is riding that decision across a continent. One unplanned stop at a time. Moving on. One commenter called it out plain. Social physics of conversation. Were social dynamics of conversations meant? And honestly, fair. But the relabeling is doing something useful here. Because Alex Pentland's research at MIT isn't philosophy. It's measurement. His team strapped sensors to 2,500 people and discovered that the structure of how groups talk predicts their performance better than the intelligence of anyone in the room. Let's pull this thread, because there's a gorgeous parallel in computing history. In 1969, BZ ARPANET went live with 4 nodes. The entire design philosophy was packet switching. No central hub routing all traffic. Messages could find their own path through the network. And what Pentland found, decades later, is that human conversation works the same way. Groups where ideas route through a single central node. The boss, the facilitator, the loudest voice. Consistently underperform groups where ideas flow peer-to-peer, like packets on a mesh network. The comments section is split in a revealing way. Some readers are thrilled to finally have data behind what they've always felt. One person said they've been advocating this for over a decade. Another commenter was less charitable, calling the article too long and repetitive, then helpfully linking directly to Pentland's original paper, which is, accidentally, a perfect demonstration of the thesis. The most useful contribution wasn't engaging with the authority at the center. It was a side channel, an informal exchange, exactly the kind of interaction Pentland says makes groups smarter. What's bemusing is how many organizations have spent the last 30 years building collaboration tools that enforce the hub and spoke model. Think about your average video call. One person shares their screen. Everyone else watches. Questions go to the presenter. Responses come from the presenter. Slack channels with a manager who answers everything. Jira boards, where every decision funnels through a product owner. We've digitized the bottleneck and called it workflow. The research says the side conversation. The ones facilitators shush, the ones managers call going off topic. Those are where collective intelligence actually lives. The open network outperforms the managed one. Distributed energy beats centralized control. We've known this about computer networks since the 60s. Apparently, it takes strapping accelerometers to people in conference rooms to learn it about ourselves. A 15-year-old use after free hiding in every Linux distribution. And someone finally found it. 15 years! A single function in the Linux kernel, remove waiter, written with one assumption baked in. That the thread calling cleanup is the thread being cleaned up. And nobody caught it. You could argue this is the case against open source security. 250,000 eyeballs. And a use after free sat in every Linux distribution shipped since 2011. Every server. Every Android phone. Every container. The many eyes make all bugs shallow. Thesis looks pretty hollow when a stack dangling pointer hides in plain sight for a decade and a half. Let me steelman this harder. The bug requires zero privileges. No special kernel config. No user namespaces. Just regular threading syscalls. An unprivileged local attacker gets a dangling pointer to kernel stack memory, writes to a near arbitrary address, hijacks a function table, and walks out with root. 97% stable. The Vega team turned it into a container escape. Google paid them $92,000, which frankly sounds low for a vulnerability with a 15-year blast radius across every major distribution on Earth. Now let me dismantle that argument against open source, because it collapses the moment you run the thought experiment in the other direction. Imagine this bug in a closed kernel. Imagine it in a proprietary operating system, where the locking subsystem is a binary blob maintained by a team of 40 engineers behind an NDA. Does it get found faster? No, it gets found by the same kind of patient, obsessive reverse engineering. Except the researchers can't publish, can't get a CVE, can't contribute to fix upstream, and can't warn the entire ecosystem simultaneously. The bug still exists for 15 years. The difference is, who knows about it, and who can act. What deserves real admiration here is the craftsmanship of the exploit analysis itself. The root cause is almost poetic in its simplicity. A helper function, remove waiter, designed for one caller, gets borrowed by a proxy lock path that violates its core invariant. The RequPI code path hands it a sleeping threads waiter, but the function scrubs current instead. The wrong task entirely. The waiter returns to user space. Its stack frame pops, and now any poll thune, cur, chain, walk follows a ghost pointer into freed memory. Elegant in the worst possible way. The fix is one conceptual line. Use the waiter's task field instead of current. That is the kind of patch that makes you stare at the ceiling wondering what else is hiding in assumptions nobody thought to question. The code was open, the bug was found, the patch shipped, the entire ecosystem can upgrade today. Run this forward. In the closed source version of this story, you never even hear about it. We talked earlier about mass producing possibility. Well, someone just mass-produced nostalgia. Next up, hardware resurrection. There's a very specific kind of person who looks at a sound card from 1995 and thinks, I should reverse engineer the programmable logic on this and publish the schematics. That person is Schley on GitHub. And the project is called Beavis Ultrasound. And yes, the name is a Beavis and Butthead reference. And yes, it is a fully open source replica of the Gravis Ultrasound PNP. For anyone who wasn't doing PC audio in the mid-90s, the Gravis Ultrasound was a weird, wonderful outlier. Most sound cards at the time used FM synthesis. Frequency modulation, basically faking instrument sounds with math. The GUS had wavetable synthesis with onboard RAM. You could load actual sampled instruments into the card's memory and play them back with hardware mixing. 32 voices simultaneously at CD quality sample rates. For tracker musicians, the people making music in Fast Tracker 2 and Impulse Tracker. This was the card. The architecture was almost entirely contained in a single AMD Interwave chip, the AM78C201, which handled PCM playback wavetable synthesis. MIDI even had a built-in codec. What makes this project remarkable is the completeness. This is not a partial schematic with hand waving. It is a four-layer PCB design, full bill of materials, fab notes down to the plating recommendations for the ISA Edge connector, and, critically, the reverse-engineered source code for the GAL, the programmable logic device that handles bus decoding and IDE buffering. That GAL is the part most clones skip because it requires actually sitting down with a logic analyzer and working out what every pin does. The author did the work and published it. The assembly notes read like a love letter to practical engineering. The ferrite beads were missing from the reference card, so the values are unknown, but you can replace them with 0-ohm resistors because... And the author points this out with gentle amusement. Ferrite beads filter at frequencies far above the audio range anyway. The PL chip slot is included for completeness, but the part apparently no longer exists. Use the two crystals instead. Reading the comments is like opening a time capsule. Someone in a post-Soviet country remembers being an ecstatic teenager with a gay US classic. Someone else harvested RAM from an old motherboard to max out their card's sample memory. Someone still regrets throwing one away 20 years ago. The tools exist, the schematics are published, the GAL code is readable. If you have an Interwave chip and a soldering iron, you can build a GUS in your kitchen. That is how open hardware is supposed to work. Not waiting for permission, not licensing someone else's IP, just doing the engineering and putting it where anyone can reach it. 6 stories in A, and every single one is about people building things they were told they couldn't. Story 6 keeps that streak alive. 3.5 standard deviations. That's where the red line sits on the Niño 3.4 sea surface temperature graph right now. Every year since 1982 is plotted in blue, forming a thick band of natural variability, the full envelope of what the tropical Pacific has done in the satellite era. The red line, this year, exits the top of that envelope and keeps going. It is not touching the previous records. It is not nudging past them. It is an empty space. This is not a projection. These are measurements. Satellites, ships, ocean boys, reporting numbers from the equatorial Pacific in near real time. The Niño 3.4 region functions as the central thermostat of global atmospheric circulation. When it warms, rainfall patterns reorganize across continents. Droughts intensify in Australia and Southeast Asia. Floods hit South America. Agricultural systems that evolved around predictable seasons encounter conditions that have no precedent in their operational history. The clinical detail that matters is this. Human emissions have raised atmospheric CO2 more than 50% since industrialization. 90% of the resulting trap heat has gone into the ocean. El Niño still oscillates the way it always has. But the baseline it oscillates around has shifted. Every warm phase now starts from a higher floor. Run that forward. A warmer ocean evaporates more water. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. Storms carry more energy. Droughts bite harder because evaporation accelerates. The natural cycle hasn't changed. The energy budget it operates within has, outing one commenter, cut through the article's framing with a single question. Okay, but what are the downstream effects? How do we model this? Fair. And the answer is that the modeling infrastructure exists. Much of it open, much of it publicly funded. NOAA's datasets are available. The climate reanalysis products are downloadable. The tools to run these numbers yourself are not locked behind institutional gates. That's the part worth paying attention to. The data is open. The observations are unambiguous. The graph is readable by anyone with an internet connection. The signal is not hidden. The instruments are not proprietary. The question is just whether anyone looked. Let's shift gears entirely. Pause from raw data to raw imagination. Composed entirely on a Macintosh Plus, using a mouse, printed on laser printers. In 1985, a comic called Shatter became the first piece of illustrated fiction ever created digitally, and the tool that made it possible was a consumer desktop computer that cost $2,500. That detail matters more than the story it told. The entire history of cyberpunk comics is a history of people picking up whatever tools they could reach. Mobius drew The Long Tomorrow in 1975 with ink and paper in a French studio, and those panels became the visual grammar that Ridley Scott built Blade Runner from. Masamune Shirow sketched tank designs in Dominion that migrated directly into Ghost in the Shell. Katsuhiro Otomo spent 8 years drawing Akira by hand across 6 volumes and 120 chapters, building a visual language for urban collapse that every artist after him could study, absorb, and build on. None of this was locked behind studio gates. None of it required permission from a distributor. The French science fiction magazines that published Mobius were small press operations. The manga serialization system in Japan gave artists like Otomo and Shiro a path from sketch to audience without corporate gatekeeping. And Shatter. That pixel art detective comic drawn with a mouse on consumer hardware proved that the barrier to entry for visual storytelling had already fallen to the price of a personal computer 40 years ago. One commenter pointed out that by the time a child is 10 years old now, they have seen every form of the hero's journey. The visual vocabulary is saturated, homogenized, flattened into content, and that is real. But the remedy is the same one these artists demonstrated across 4 decades. Put the tools in people's hands and get out of the way. The through line from Mobius to Shatter to Ghost in the Shell is not aesthetic influence. It is access. Each work existed because someone could make it with what they had. Publish it through channels that didn't require permission, and let the next person build on it. That is bootstrapism. The genre that warned us about corporate control was built entirely outside of it. This one is pure joy. Entire computing histories, preserved and playable. Running in spaces smaller than a thumbnail. Based on the title, URL, and the reader comments, which mention pin-level emulation, ZX Spectrum, Bruce Lee game, tape loading, modular component interfaces, and the creator's own comment about the proper URL, I have enough context to write this segment. When I was first learning to build emulators, the decision that haunted every design session was granularity. How deep do you model? Instruction level gets you compatibility. Cycle level gets you accuracy. But pin level? Pin level means you are modeling the actual electrical signals between chips. Every active high, every active low, every bus transaction. It is the difference between writing a biography and sequencing someone's genome. That is what makes André Weisflog's Tiny Emulators project extraordinary. This is a collection of 8-bit system emulators. ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64, Amstrad CPC, several others. Running entirely in the browser, built on a pin-level emulation model where each chip is a self-contained module communicating through explicitly defined interfaces. The same way actual silicon talks to actual silicon on a real circuit board from 1982. Consider what that architecture gives you. In most emulators, the CPU, the sound chip, the video hardware, they are tangled together in a shared state machine. Accuracy depends on getting the interleaving right. And every new system means re-architecting the whole thing. Weisflog's approach treats each component like a Lego brick with standardized connectors. The Z80 does not know it is inside a Spectrum or an Amstrad. It just sees pins. Voltage in, voltage out. The modularity is not abstraction for convenience. It mirrors how the actual hardware was designed. There is something in orchestral composition called transparent scoring, where you can hear every instrument's line independently, even in full ensemble. That is what pin-level emulation achieves for hardware. You can trace a signal from the CPU's address bus through the memory decoder to the RAM chip and watch each gate respond. The system is legible at every layer. One commenter captured the emotional core perfectly. Games that used to take eons to load from cassette tape now appear in a split second. Bruce Lee on the Spectrum, instantly. The waiting was real, the tape heads grinding, the screen flickering with loading bars, the pray it doesn't crash anticipation. All of that friction dissolved. And the whole thing is open source. The chip's library is on GitHub, written in C, compiled to WebAssembly. Anyone can take these components, wire up a new system, contribute improvements. This is how preservation actually works. Not locked in a museum, but running in your browser tab with the source code right there for the next person who wants to understand how a Z80 negotiates a bus request. The craft here deserves real admiration. Building one accurate emulator is hard. Building a component library that lets you snap together accurate emulators like circuit boards. That is engineering art. We talked about elegant constraint solving earlier. Here's another beautiful example. Let's talk about backtrack precursor. When was the last time you questioned a tool you learned as a child? Not the big thing. Religion, politics, values. But something as mundane as the shape of a letter. Someone sat down, ran Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment through a backtracking analysis, and discovered that English cursive requires you to retrace your steps for 51% of all words. Every other word you write demands that you stop, go back, dot an I, cross a T, maintain a mental queue of unfinished business. Russian cursive? 6.4%. Almost nothing. The numbers are striking, but the question nobody seems to be asking is this. Why did we just accept it? Generations of English speakers learned cursive as if the letter shapes were natural law, never noticing that the alphabet was fighting them the entire time. Meanwhile, Cyrillic writers flow through whole paragraphs in unbroken strokes, and nobody told them they were lucky. The fix is elegant. The author redesigned four letters. A-G-S-T-I-J. To eliminate every backtrack, the new T borrows a stroke pattern from the digit 4, mirrored. It already appears on bakery logos across Zurich. The eye gets its stock connected directly to the stem in a single fluid motion. The whole system is published openly, with the analysis, the methodology. The letter forms. Take it. Modify it. Use it. What I love about this is the builder instinct. Most people would complain about cursive being annoying and move on. This person quantified the annoyance, isolated the root cause, engineered a solution, and shared the blueprints. Shared the work. That is the tinkerer's reflex at its finest. A small, beautiful optimization that makes you wonder how many other everyday tools we use are just waiting for someone to actually look at them. We talked earlier about tools for understanding. Here's one that hands you the keys to the universe itself. In 1961, Richard Feynman walked into a freshman lecture hall at Caltech and did something radical. He took the entire edifice of physics, quantum mechanics, electromagnetism, thermodynamics, relativity, and laid it out for people who didn't know it yet. Not a dumbed-down version. The real thing. Those lectures got transcribed, published, and for decades, they were the gold standard for self-taught physicists worldwide. Free, eventually. Open. The knowledge just sitting there for anyone stubborn enough to pick it up. Susan Rigetti did something structurally identical, but arguably more useful. She wrote a curriculum, not a textbook, not a lecture series. A map. Here's what to read, in what order, and why. The kind of thing a good advisor gives you on your first day of grad school. Except, she gave it to the entire internet. 600,000 people have used it. Some went on to get degrees. Most didn't. Most just wanted to understand the universe, which is... Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Supposedly what universities exist for. And yet the academic physics community, by Rigetti's account, doesn't take these people seriously. If you're not enrolled, you're not real. Here's where the engineering elegance lives. The guide itself is almost trivially simple. It's a reading list with commentary. But the design decision that makes it work is the sequencing. The dependency graph of concepts laid out so a motivated person can traverse it alone. That's the advisor in a box. That's the gatekeeping function of universities extracted and published. The comments are telling. People arguing about which textbook is better, recommending video series, debating pacing strategies. A community of self-directed learners doing what learners do. Teaching each other. The curriculum became a commons. One person's knowledge, shared openly, compounding across 600,000 minds. That's the bootstrap at work. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 13th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something with whatever you've got in reach. We'll see you back here tomorrow.